Let's get back to the Anajar and Levine Accident Attorney Studios. This is Russo and Rizzo on ESPN 106.3.
It's Russo and Rizzo on a Monday edition of the program, December the 1st, 2025. You got Colin Russo and Mike Rizzo, Christian Cat here, as always, at the City Place Studios in downtown West Palm Beach. Well, the YMCA of the Palm Beaches has their 16th annual prayer breakfast coming up December 11th at the Breakers. We're over there in Palm Beach. Tickets are still available at ymcapalmbeaches.org. You can hear from all the great people that are going to be over there, including which he's the Super Bowl champion. He's the College Hall of Famer. He's the former Redskins quarterback. It is Mr. Joe Theismann that is going to join us now on Russo and Rizzo. Joe, welcome in. How are we doing today? What's going on?
Good morning, guys. Just starting with Thanksgiving Day. It's been an unbelievable weekend of football, and looking forward to coming to Palm Beach and seeing everybody and saying hello and doing some great things for the YMCA.
Yeah, Joe, tell us a little bit about how you got involved with the YMCA and what are you most looking forward to about coming down here, being at that annual prayer breakfast, and seeing the development right here with the YMCA in Palm Beach.
Well, there's some great, you know, they're building a new complex and there's lots of great things happening. YMCA does so many wonderful things for so many people, and, you know, Palm Beach is expanding and I'm doing everything I can to help people, you know, raise money to make sure that, you know, the opportunities are there for the people that need it. And it's a great honor, I think, to be able to be invited to speak and have a chance to visit with everybody down in the Palm Beach area.
The YMCA of the Palm Beaches .org for more information. Go visit today. Joe Theismann with us. Now, Joe, we'll get into all the current day football stuff. I know there's a lot of conversation surrounding Notre Dame and how they stand in the college football playoff and everything like that, especially with the Commanders. We'll get into all of that. I'm so fascinated by your career, and I was hoping we could get into it a little bit because I think no career sort of is emulated such as yours because it's one of resilience. It's up and downs, especially throughout your college career. You're a New Jersey guy. And growing up, going to Notre Dame, being on a couple great Notre Dame teams, you've had a couple great moments, and more than a couple, I should say. Can we start at the beginning? And I'm curious how a guy from New Jersey, how our era Parsegan gets over to Notre Dame. Were you born and raised a Notre Dame fan? Did that sort of fall about? How'd that go down?
No, really. As a matter of fact, my high school coach was a guy by the name of Ron Wojcicki. He backed up, and, you know, maybe some of the younger people have to Google this name. Roman Gabriel was a great quarterback for the Rams. And Ron was a backup to him at North Carolina State. And when I was visiting different schools, I picked out five different schools, Penn State, Notre Dame, Wake Forest, UNC, and North Carolina State. I signed at North Carolina State because I thought, hey, it was a great idea and no real other reason behind it. And then after all the recruiting stuff, Notre Dame came to me and said, we'd like you to make a visit out to the university. I said, well, I already signed at NC State. They said, that's okay. We're an independent. At that time, if you change schools and it was in a conference, you'd have to lose a year of eligibility. Well, Notre Dame was an independent, flew out to South Bend, flew back to New Jersey, met my dad at the airport. He says, what do you think? I said, I have to go to Notre Dame. He said, why? I said, Dad, it just feels right. And I contend this, that our gut probably makes better decisions for us than by the time we sit down and go through all kinds of analytics and all kinds of statistics and everything else that we want to reason. And it was just a gut feeling, and it turned out to be a pretty darn good one. I love my time at the university. Started my career there as a punt returner for the first seven games of my sophomore year because freshmen were not eligible. And there was about 6,800 guys at the university. It was all male at that time.
Joe,
it was an unbelievable experience.
Joe, what do you think the most important thing you learned at Notre Dame was that first year? You know, I mean, we see a ton of freshmen immediately play in college football, but that just wasn't really how it went back in the day, correct?
No, it wasn't. It taught you discipline. It taught you how to prepare. It taught you how to get ready for games. It taught you how to stand in a huddle. It taught you how to communicate in a huddle. There's so many little nuances that go into the position that people don't really consider. You know, communication is so vitally important. There are guys that are great athletes that just don't speak clearly. And in a huddle with you got 80, 90,000 people screaming, yelling, they have to hear what you're saying. Now, a lot of times they signaling things from the sidelines, as we did, but you still have to be able to communicate to the players what you're doing. And I just, you know, all the little, the work habits, the work ethic you develop. Ara Parsegan was my coach, holding people accountable for responsibilities that they have. all those little things you learn in your early years in school, as far as I was concerned.
And Joe, Terry Hanratty, a great Notre Dame quarterback as well, goes down before you. You step up in 1968, and then through those next couple of years, Notre Dame plays in a couple huge games, the two Cotton Bowls against Texas. You had that tie against USC. But was that a sort of next man up mentality when you got the call midpoint of 1968? Was Joe Theismann ready, or were you thrown into the fire?
I guess Era felt I was ready. But I'd practiced. That's the only thing he could evaluate it on. As a matter of fact, you know, I played the last three games, Pittsburgh, Georgia Tech, and USC in 1968. And his 90th birthday, when I was out to see Era at South Bend, I asked him, it was the only time I'd ever asked him. This, you know, God, it'd been like 45, 50 years. And I said, why me? He had Coley O'Brien, who quarterbacked the Notre Dame team in 66 to a national championship, had another senior. Coley was a senior. Bob Belden was the other quarterback. He was a senior. There was Terry Hanratty and me. And it was, I think, a Friday afternoon that Terry tweaked his knee and got hurt. And Era said, you're in. And, you know, you talk about defining moments in a life. The way people look at you in the huddle, the way you voice plays, the way you break the huddle, the way you get to the line of scrimmage, trying to do things with an authoritative nature, just to know that you belong. I guess I was so innocent at that time. I didn't know to be scared. I felt like I was ready. I never really had a problem feeling a little cocky, I guess you could say. And I just took the bull by the horns and started playing. We had, you know, a great game against Pitt, great game against Georgia Tech, and then the tie with USC. And from that point forward, I had the opportunity to be able to, you know, be the quarterback at the University of Notre Dame, which is just an incredible experience.
And Joe, what did Era say when you asked him, why me, when you had all those other options on the team?
He just said, I felt you were ready. He had Coley. Coley wound up playing halfback and Bob was a backup, but it was ironic that, you know, he had all these seniors and me. And really, when I went to the university, I was one of 13 quarterbacks.
Wow.
See, back in the late six, what they did back in the late is they recruited athletes at the Notre Dame University. They recruited, they would get a great athlete. They would make him a defensive back or a running back or a wide receiver or something else. I was 5 feet 10 and 155 pounds. Excuse me. So there wasn't much they could do with me except let me play quarterback. So that's how I wound up keeping the job at quarterback, because I was just a skinny little kid. And as a matter of fact, I graduated from college at 175. Never played heavier in the NFL for 15 years at over 185. They wouldn't even look at me. I mean, today, if I came out of school today as the size I was, I wouldn't even get a sniff.
Was there a part in your early professional career where you thought this quarterback thing was not going to work out? Because I think your story is something of resilience, something you'd never see today. You'd never see a quarterback pucker up and go over to the Canadian Football League, play for 3 years, then work his way up and go, you know, splitting with Billy Kilmer, 38 years old, and then work your way up to be the starting quarterback once Joe Gibbs gets into town. I mean, it's really fascinating, but did you think at any point that this was not going to work out at a professional level?
No, never felt that way. Never believed I could not do it. I believed I could do it. I believed I could play. You know, that was the one thing about playing at the University of Notre Dame. There's a thing I talk about in my speeches about validation. We're always seeking validation. And when I had a chance to play against the University of Southern California, specifically because of so many guys they put into the NFL, and I felt like I held my own pretty well against them. I felt like I belonged. And then when I went to the Canadian Football League, it gave me a chance to continue to play football, not just stand on the sidelines and quote-unquote learn. It's like people say, well, you know, you learn on the sidelines. You really don't. It would be like reading a book on tennis and thinking you're going to go play Rafael Nadal and think, oh, well, you know, I can do well. I read a book on it. It doesn't work that way. So I actually had game management experience when I went to the CFL. And so when I came back to the U.S., it was, you know, I ran scout team. I was a wide receiver on a scout team. We were playing the Rams one in 1974. Billy's the quarterback. 74, 75. Billy's the quarterback. We're down to two wide receivers, and we had three wide receiver sets. So Billy comes to the sidelines, and Teddy Marchibroda was the coach. He said, we're down a receiver. He said, well, who's the third one? And I'm standing there, and Billy and Teddy says, Joe's the third receiver. And Billy said, we can go with two. And so that was That was foundationally the way our relationship went all those years there. But I have tremendous admiration for both Billy and Sonny. Nobody threw the ball prettier than Sonny, and nobody was tougher than Billy. And I learned a lot, you know, in hindsight, whether I wanted to or not, I learned a lot from those guys.
Wow. Joe Theismann joining us now, the former Redskin quarterback. The Redskins in the 70s were strange because the George Allen years into the Jack Pardee years, you mentioned Sonny Jurgensen was kind of that initial guy, and then Kilmer sort of took it over. They're two quarterback sets. And then you come in and you start kind of doing the same thing. Up until Pardee left and Joe Gibbs got there, it was a little bit of you. Billy Kimber went down. Kilmer went down for a couple of games, and you came back in. It's, again, something you rarely see nowadays in the NFL. It was a different game with how they kind of approached the quarterback position. It wasn't until Joe Gibbs got there that it got sort of consistent with you. But tell me a little bit about how that has changed, being, you know, sort of a couple games in, couple games out. Did that sort of demoralize you at any point, if being performance-based or a week-by-week basis?
No, not really. You know, I mean, you seize the opportunity when it's there, no matter how long it is or how short it is. You just want to be able to be out on the football field. You know, give me a chance to show you what I got. And then if you don't think I'm good enough, then that's your decision. But just give me a chance to get on the field. Actually, Jack Pardee really named me the starter in 78 when Jack took over for George. So I played 78, 79. We had a really good run. 80, we had a lousy year. Coach Pardee gets fired. And Joe comes in 81. We start our season 0-5 under Coach Gibbs. So, and he's, you know, he's looking to make a change at quarterback. I'd heard that he was going to trade me. So I drove to his house after we lost to the 49ers. I believe it was the fifth game of the season. I drove to his house, and I sat down with him, and I said, I knocked on the door, and Joe used to sleep at Redskin Park Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday night.
Wow.
By the time the weekend rolled around, he was spent. So here I am, after the game, knocking on his door. I said, Coach, we need to talk. Sat down in his den with him, and I said, Coach, you know, I just get the sense that, you know, you don't want me to be your quarterback. He said, Joe, you got a lot going on. I had restaurants, TV shows, radio shows, all kinds of stuff. I said, I'll tell you what, I'll get rid of everything. That's how important me and the quarterback of the Washington Redskins is to me. I'll get rid of everything. I said, just give me a chance. Instead of judging me, give me a chance. And from the sixth game of 1981, we went 8-3, 12-1, 16-4, 11-5. Until I got hurt at 5-5 in 85. And it was just really, you know, I think Joe had a preconceived notion that I was involved in other things and football wasn't that important to me. And I guess the lesson there is, if you really want something, let people know how important it is to you and then do everything you can to accomplish what you want to go after. You know, don't, and this is another thing too, is don't let preconceived notions make judgments for people going forward on individuals. Just because somebody comes from some place or they look differently or something like that, don't judge them. Do they fit the bill for what you need? That's the most important thing.
Wow. And Joe, let's get into it. 1985, Monday Night Football, Lawrence Taylor, the play in November that sort of ended your career. And I know you've talked a lot about it, about how it sort of was a blessing in disguise. It gave you a lot of humility and understanding of your purpose and everything like that. But I want to talk about sort of in the short term, right when that happened, that next couple of weeks, did that all seem like a blur to you when that happened? The realization that you might never play again, was that apparent from the early get-go? And what were the conversations like around the team? Did you talk to LT? Tell me about that a little bit.
Well, no, I never really thought it was the end because I'd broken my leg in Canada in 1972, but I only broke one bone then, and I was back in 6 weeks. In my mind, I was coming back to play football. I was prepared to, you know, take that rest of that year. It was the 10th game of the season. And so, you know, I'd lose 85, but then I'd be back in 86. I just signed a brand new 5-year contract. So I was bound and determined to come back and play. I worked real hard to come back and play. And then when I went to work out for, I also had an insurance policy and I had to work out for the insurance company and I had to work out for our trainers and the organization. And I just couldn't move. 2 years later, I was able to move, but I'd be 37 and nobody would have wanted me anyway. But that night was, you know, I remember everything. I can close my eyes and feel the moisture on my back and see the big Longines clock at 10:05 PM, in the stadium, which is being torn down and a new one's going to be built. But yeah, a lot of things happened around that. And, you know, Lawrence and I have had conversations. You know, I kid him all the time. I say, you know what? People didn't know who you were until you hurt me. I just want you to understand that. You were just a great linebacker, people thought. But, you know, I made you famous. We love to bust each other on that kind of stuff. And he was, you know, the other thing, too, is that night, if people ever look at it, I've only seen it once in 40 years. He was so emotionally distraught over what had taken place and what he saw that, you know, he was jumping up and down and screaming at the sidelines and everything to get everybody out there. And, you know, as a matter of fact, he called me that next morning in the hospital.
Oh, he did.
I'll never forget this. Yeah, he called me. Nurse comes walking in. He says, she said, Mr. Thies, Mr. Taylor's on the phone. Would you like to speak to him? I said, give me the phone. He said, LT, is that you? He says, yeah, Joe, how you doing? I said, not very well. This is why. I said, why? You broke both bones in my leg, for crying out loud. He says, Joe, you have to understand something. I don't do things halfway. Got to go to practice. Talk to you later. Bye. That was
oh, gosh.
That was one of those moments. That was one of the conversations we had, you know, after the injury. But he is, we still see each other, you know, at different autograph sessions and around, and we kid each other. You know, people talk about great players. He was the most incredible outside linebacker. And his physical presence was something else. I mean, he was fast, he was quick, he was strong, he was big. But he had a way of diagnosing plays. He could start on one side of the formation and get to the other side quicker than anybody I've ever seen. Greatest outside linebacker ever. You know, today you've got edge rushers. Everybody has different distinctions. But he played the outside linebacker position. And as a matter of fact, we had such respect for him when we were playing the Giants. You know, in football, when coaches put up diagrams of a defense, they put the V's are like defensive linemen, the B's are backers, the S's are safeties, the C's are corners. Well, when we used to play the Giants, there were 10 letters up there and one number, 56, with a big circle around it. Pay attention to where he is all the time. That was the message that they gave us.
Joe, with your great career, I mean, college, NFL, what's the biggest lesson that football taught you during your playing career?
Never let anybody tell you can't do something. From the time I was a skinny little kid going to the University of Notre Dame, matter of fact, there was a headline in a Newark, New Jersey newspaper said, Thiesman will get killed at Notre Dame. You know, I tell people all the time, don't let somebody determine your future. Don't let somebody go out and tell you that you can't do or be something. You determine that for yourself. And that's one of the great things I think about the YMCA, is it gives people confidence to be able to go forward, to be able to do the things that they want to do. And that's important. You know, believing that you can get it done is half the battle, more than half the battle. And then don't have somebody say, well, you know, you're not qualified for this, you can't do it. Well, then move on to something else that you are qualified for and be really great at it. And don't settle for just being good. If you're going to do something, why don't you try and be great at it? Just take it to the next level. What do I need to do? See, I tell people all the time, you want to be great at something, talk to people who are great. Find out how they got there, and maybe some of the things that they do will allow you to be able to pursue a similar role to get where you want to go.
You can hear Joe Thiesman talk at the YMCA of the Palm Beach at 16th Annual Prayer Breakfast, which is coming up December 11th at the Breakers in Palm Beach. Go to ymcapalmbeaches.org to still get tickets. Joe, a couple more things here. Let's go to present day. You're a Notre Dame guy. Notre Dame's kind of in the middle of, you mentioned they're an independent. We know they're an independent. I think everybody has an opinion of them being an independent. But a couple things.
Sure.
They're on the outside, inside, outside looking in. One foot in, one foot out of the college football playoff. Nobody knows whether they should get in. Miami beat them head-to-head. Miami has an argument to the fact that, hold on, if one of us is going to get a bid, why don't we? Because we beat them head-to-head. Notre Dame, on the other hand, is thinking...
They made a lucky catch.
a lucky catch
in the end zone. That's why, okay, I'll analyze that situation for you. No, I think Notre Dame should get in. We've been ranked ninth. You know, we started back at 21. We've been ranked ninth. Very similar to the path we took a year ago. Lost early, came back. We've done the same thing. We've been very dominant over the last 4 or 5 weeks. We've put up some huge numbers. Miami hasn't put up those kind of numbers. So I think that, you know, obviously there is that conversation between Notre Dame and Miami, but I really believe that Notre Dame deserves to be in the college football playoffs. And I'm praying, I guess you could say, that they are. I hope they get a shot again, because and Notre Dame will be one of the teams. But if you look at the 12 teams that are going to be in the playoffs, there's a lot of great football teams there. A lot of great defenses there as well, of which Notre Dame has one. So I think it's going to be probably one of the most exciting tournaments that we'll be able to witness going forward with the college football playoffs.
So, Joe, Texas has three losses. The Ohio State loss is going to be the one that burns them, because if they schedule Little Sisters of the Poor, they have two losses. Miami has two losses, but Miami beats Notre Dame head-to-head early on in the season. Like, what I'm trying to get to is here, what would you tell a fan that says, why are we scheduling these big-time games early on in the year if we're not reaping the benefits from these big-time games early on in the year? Because Steve Sarkisian's going, listen, we played the best team in the country and we only lost by one score. Now, Joe, I'm an Ohio State man. That wasn't a one-score game, but the score says it. And then Miami beats Notre Dame. They have the same amount of losses, and they're about to be left out. What would you tell somebody that's kind of getting hot and heavy about the early matchups not mattering anymore at the end of the season?
I have no explanation. I'm the same way as everybody else. Why do you do that? You look at some of these teams who they play in the beginning of the year. They're just games that people pay just to get some money, and they go get beat up in the process. We start with Miami, then we get Texas A&M. We lose that one right at the end. Look at the game itself. Those were two terrific football games Notre Dame played. Wound up, sort of an odd man out. A little bit like the Commanders last night against the Denver Broncos. It gets down to the last play, gets down to the wire. I think you have to look at the quality of what the teams did going forward from there. Maybe that's their evaluation process, but heavens, I'm like you. Sometimes I scratch my head and wonder why somebody's where they are.
And Joe, with the playoff coming up, Notre Dame, I'm going to assume that they're probably going to get in, but I'm curious from your perspective here. Notre Dame, a couple years ago, had Brian Kelly with the team maybe waiting to see if they get into the postseason. LSU comes in and poaches Brian Kelly. Marcus Freeman steps in as defensive coordinator, and off they go. You could make the argument that Notre Dame was better off. Now, basically the same thing just happened with Ole Miss, with Lane Kiffin being poached by LSU, and Ole Miss is waiting to see if they're in the postseason, and Ole Miss takes their defensive coordinator and promotes them upward. Now, Notre Dame is not necessarily known as a stepping stone job. Brian Kelly did it. Ole Miss, you can make the same argument, could be a stepping stone job. I'm curious on the coaching carousel that we've seen in the college football landscape, your perspective on coaches leaving before these teams even play big time games, whether it be a big bowl game or a postseason game. Do you blame more the committee, or do you blame more the NCAA, or do you blame these coaches for hitching the town and getting out of there before the big game's being played?
I think there's blame to be put everywhere. What I don't understand is if Lane told LSU, I will be your coach, but I want to coach my guys who I recruited at Ole Miss, the guys that put their hearts on the line for me, the guys that did everything I asked them to do, the coaches that did everything I asked them to do. Do you think LSU would say, no, we're going to go someplace else?
I
really think that they would have said, hey, sorry, Lane, the job was yours, but you don't want it. We'll find somebody else. They felt that I believe he was their guy long before Brian Kelly got fired. When Brian got to the beginning of this year and struggled, I felt like they were hunting and looking, and I think he was number one on their list, my personal opinion.
Could you make the argument?
Don't know any information about it.
Now, Joe, could you make the argument that it was an Ole Miss thing? Ole Miss said, hold on, well, why would LSU's future coach our team when he's making that decision to leave? Whether you're making the argument that they should have waited a month, obviously, that's the best case scenario for everybody. That's just not how the NCAA works for some odd reason that nobody can explain. But wouldn't Ole Miss say, from a pride perspective, hey, this is an in-conference rival. Why would we let this guy coach another month when we know he's going to leave and hightail it out of there the first chance he gets?
Well, then that's the decision. Obviously, that's the decision they came to. And I certainly respect the decision Ole Miss made, just not having him do it. He wanted to do it. I listened to a little bit of his interviews last night. He wanted to do it. Sure he did. But he also wanted to go to LSU. So you have to make, it's like choosing. You've got to make a choice. Yep. You're either here. And I think he accomplished everything that he wanted to at Ole Miss. And this was moving on to something else that was challenging. And obviously the economics were always going to be there, I think, for Lane. I don't think the numbers are just crazy. I mean, his is at a 6-year deal. At least somebody at a university wised up and decided not to give 10-year deals to people anymore. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just, to me, it should be a 5-5 if you want, or 5-5. You know, the most you should get is 5, and then if you do well, you get more. But, you know, Lane's got a 6-year deal at LSU, and, you know, you'll see what happens going forward. You know, Brian left Notre Dame to go to LSU, and that didn't work out very well for him. And that was like over a 4-year period. But I think it's tough on the players. It's tough on their families. It's tough on the coaches, you know, and then telling them, hey, if you're not on the plane tomorrow, then you're not on my staff. I don't think that's right, to be honest with you. You're going to penalize guys that have given their heart and soul to you. And then all of a sudden, if you don't make this plane, you're not going to be a part of what I'm going forward to. I didn't think that was very, you know, very nice. But he, you know, it has 1,000 different tentacles to it. It's an ugly octopus, to be honest with you. I mean, it's just there's no right answer, and I think you can argue say there's no wrong answer. I think Ole Miss made the right decision for the university. I respect them tremendously for what they've done. And Lane has moved on, as he has previously at other places. This isn't like the first move that Lane Kiffin has made. You know, he's moved before. So, you know, we'll see what happens going forward.
Joe, last thing here for me, loaded question for you. With the football season kind of coming to an end here on the college side, we're a couple weeks out from the NFL playoffs. Who's your favorite on the college side? And with a couple weeks left in the NFL, who do you like there as well?
On the college side, you know, If I'm going to be a neutral observer, I think Ohio State's a heck of a football team. Okay, from a University of Notre Dame foot standpoint, we get in the playoffs, love another shot at Ohio State. Okay, and I think Indiana is going to be a handful. Texas Tech's going to be a handful. That's what I'm saying. These playoffs, I think, are going to be really, really unbelievable. North Texas, you know, you look at what they've been doing. Ole Miss. You know, are they going to be inspired to, if they, you know, they stay where they are and get in, you know, what happens there? But I think when you look at Ohio State and the way that football team plays, they're a heck of a football team. Like I said, I think Notre Dame's playing, you know, CJ has grown up at the quarterback position there for us. And, you know, Jeremiah Love is the best player in college football. It's a shame that people aren't talking about him. All they're doing is talking about, listen to me, all they're doing is talking about quarterback. Here I am, a quarterback, saying why don't you consider the best running back in football and the best college football player in Jeremiah Love? He's phenomenal. But, you know, I think Ohio State's probably a team that, you know, is going to be a tough out. Let's put it that way. And then we get to see a little bit of what Indiana and Ohio State look like this weekend coming up when they play in the Big Ten Championship. And as far as the NFL goes, I think if the Houston Texans keep coming the way they're coming, they're going to be a scary football team. You know, I wouldn't count the Kansas City Chiefs out quite yet. You know, they had a chance to win that game. They dropped some balls. They've gone back to what they did a few years ago. They're dropping important passes that allow them the opportunity to be able to win games. I mean, that's, you know, Philadelphia has a lot of uncertainty around it. The Rams losing to the, you know, Panthers yesterday, make you scratch your head and go, okay, what's up with the Rams? You know, Matthew Stafford, MVP, Rams, best football team, you know, not quite yet. I still think there's a lot of growth. The Dallas Cowboys are coming on. You know, I think that's a team that if they do get in the playoffs, they're going to be a scary football team. So to say who's what in the NFL right now, I think the AFC and the NFC is just a hodgepodge of a bunch of football teams that have to find some consistency. And they have to get people healthy.
I don't think you're wrong. Joe, we appreciate you giving us the time. Truly a great interview. You gave us longer than you needed to. We do truly appreciate it. Looking forward to that YMCA of the Palm Beach 16th annual breakfast. And looking forward to speaking again hopefully soon, Joe. All right? You take care.
Thanks, Joe.
Thanks, guys. I appreciate it. Look forward to seeing you. Bye.
All right. That's Joe Theismann, the former Redskin quarterback, the College Football Hall of Famer for Notre Dame. Throughout the 1968 through 1970 seasons. Appreciate Joe. You can hear him at the YMCA of the Palm Beach at 16th Annual Prayer Breakfast, December 11th at the Breakers Palm Beach. Tickets are still available at ymcapalmbeaches.org. Russo and Rizzo, Colin Russo, Mike Rizzo, Christian Catt. We'll take a time out here on ESPN 106.3.
Let's get back to the Anajar and Levine Accident Attorney Studios. This is Russo and Rizzo on ESPN 106.3.
Boy, are we blessed on a Wednesday. We got back-to-back Hall of Famers. We just talked to Joe Theismann, the College Football Hall of Famer, and the former Redskins quarterback, segueing right into Steve Pollitt Sr., the Palm Beach Sports Commission Hall of Famer, the Palm Beach Gardens Youth Athletic Association Vice President and the Good Karma Brands President, joining us now on Russo and Rizzo with Colin Russo and Mike Rizzo. Steve, how are you?
Doing great. Joe and I done a few events together over the years. So, natural segue.
There you go. All right, Steve, we're going to do this a little differently. You're going to get we're going to get your thoughts on some current events. Christian's going to run this. Let's do a little 5 and 5 presented by Flagler Credit Union.
Five topics.
High five.
5 o'clock.
It's 5 o'clock somewhere. Let's get out of here.
Endless takes.
You can't handle the truth.
All gas, no brakes.
And it's shaking, big time.
It's time for the 5 at 5.
Hold on to your butts.
Presented by Flagler Credit Union, proud supporter of FAU Athletics. Number one.
Well, the latest college football playoff rankings, the penultimate CFP rankings, were released last night on ESPN, and it went as follows, where it matters most for the Hurricane fans out there: Notre Dame, BYU, Miami, outside of those top nine. My question for you, Colin, Mike, and, well, Steve, if BYU loses to Texas Tech, should they be punished in regards to the CFP rankings?
BYU?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think if they look, there, it stinks. I'm pro BYU. My perspective is BYU's in a position where they have to give the committee absolutely no choice but to put them in. The only way to do that is to win the Big 12.
Yep.
That's the only thing they could possibly do, is to win that game. Do I think it's a little unfair that they're not an at-large, or at least floated as an at-large with at least a game to go? Yeah, I think it's a little unfair, being an 11-1 Power 4. But this is sort of the bed that they're in right now. But the good news is you control your own destiny.
Winning in. It's that simple for me. Winning in. If BYU wins, they're in. If they lose, they're out. And I sadly, even if it is a close game, Colin, and Uncle Steve, I still think they are out. But this is this is where we're at. This is where we're at in college football, where it depends on what conference you play in, the wins, and how you've been lately. If BYU loses two games to their only good team that they played all season long at Texas Tech, remember, they lost to Texas Tech 29-7 in the regular season. So this would be their second loss. Winning, you're in at BYU. It's simple for me, Uncle Steve.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, this thing is never going to be perfect, right? The name on the jersey is going to matter, and it is going to have undue influence. They have to be more impressive. I think Colin said it. And they're not going to get any special treatment.
Do you think
people do?
You think Miami's unfairly left out, Steve?
I think their losses are so bad. That's the problem. It's just their losses are so bad, and they were at a time almost like their losses are amplified because they were at a moment where, like, they could have. There was so much tumult during that time. Don't you feel like their losses were considered worse?
Yep.
Because there was like, oh, Miami's about to break through and be right atop. What? They lost to Louisville in terrible fashion and then laid an egg against SMU? So I do think they're getting harsh judgment. I think they're getting it a little harsh, but I think it was like really bad timing on their losses.
Number two.
Let's go to the National Football League, where Bill Belichick and Robert Kraft, of course, the two components in the Patriots dynasty, were picked as finalists for the 2026 Pro Football Hall of Fame class. Who was better at what they do, or who is better at what they do, Bill Belichick at coaching pro football, or Robert Kraft at owning a pro football team?
There is a skill to owning. Robert Kraft is not the best of all time at owning a team. Bill Belichick is probably, as it stands right now, the best all-time NFL head coach. Because of that, I would lean Belichick.
I think it's between him and Coach Shula. Obviously, Coach Shula coaching the greatest NFL team of all time, the undefeated Dolphins. I probably lean Bill as well. I do. And, Colin, you're going to hate me for this, but North Carolina, number 17-ranked recruiting class this year. So I expect them to be better next year with a full boat of recruits down there in North Carolina. I lean Belichick, Uncle Steve.
Yeah, I think you're looking at what happened on the field. No, let's just give me the – let me give you the other side of this. Kraft gave him a lot of freedom. Kraft gave him a lot of leeway, right? This wasn't just a coach – who didn't have a lot to work with. I feel like Kraft was supportive a lot of decisions that were made, trades, cutting veterans, you know, things of that. Kraft also, you have to look at what he did off the field. You know, he was a huge part of the media committee that helped really grow the NFL, you know, to the behemoth that it is today, to the envy of every other league. This isn't just Kraft going in as an owner. He has served on so many senior committees and such an advisor to Roger Goodell and, you know, his predecessor, Paul Tagliabue, who passed away, like, over the years, that I think it's more. He's deserving as well. You got to go Belichick first. Now, what about them going guys? Is that weird? You know, like, they've had their ups and downs?
Now, listen, Uncle Steve, I'm all for it, but I don't think they'd be all for it. You know what I'm saying? Isn't there bad blood? Like, there was a giant you-know-what match before the year of Bill not being allowed in New England, and then Bill saying no Patriot people are allowed at North Carolina. I just don't think that they would even want to remotely be around each other right now. Am I wrong on that?
You would hope they would bury the hatchet prior to that. But the one thing at these things, you could just... It's not like... You're in a few pictures together, but it's not like you're, you know, like doing interviews together the whole time that you're there. You know, you have your own entourage, your own family. I would think they would coexist.
Yeah, you think they'd bury the hatchet for that. What's number three?
We're going to the association where Giannis Antetokounmpo and his agents have started conversations with the Bucks about possibly moving to a different team or exploring other options in the future. Of course, the trade deadline is a little over 2 months away. If Giannis is traded, where will he go? If you were guess, based on fit.
No, longtime Knick fan, Steve Politino is with us now. I wonder what he thinks. I think, weirdly enough, it sucks to say, the best package can be made by the Thunder. I don't think they'll ever do it. I think San Antonio makes a lot more sense.
They might not need to. Like, as far as the Thunder, they're 21-1. Do they really need to make that move to go out?
Probably
and get
not. And then you look at the Knicks. Do the Knicks need to do it? Steve, what are you saying?
You know, the Knicks would try because of the fanfare that's going on. You know, that's going on there. But I actually think you have to look at a team not that far away from Milwaukee, like Detroit, that might be. They're dominating in the East. They are definitely a veteran away than the Bucks would take back, like a Tobias Harris, who is still a serviceable veteran, and then you could start to make the numbers work. You know, I'm not the trade machine in terms of making the numbers work, but I could see something like that, and you put him with Cade Cunningham, well, that could be lethal.
All right, first off, Tobias Harris is not going to cut it. I mean, they're going to need to put in Jalen Duren. They're going to need to put in two or three young assets, every pick they have.
They got the young guys. They got Holland. They got Ivy. They got Haskins. I was at the game, the Pistons game against the Heat the other day. Like, they have a wealth of young talent that are going to be around for years that would really actually help the Bucks rebuild. I just thought of that on the fly. I'm pretty into that.
Detroit Pistons, number one team in the Eastern Conference.
Exactly why I wouldn't do it.
And I said the Cavaliers, Steve, but the problem is it's intra-division. I'd be right there with you with the Pistons and or the Cavs, but it's in the division.
They're going to need a really good offer to trade them in the conference.
The Central Division, you played that team four times a year. So, like, that's why I don't think it'd be that. I think the teams that make sense quickly, boys, the Knicks and the Spurs. I said maybe the Heat, Uncle Steve, as a dark horse. You would need to give up a lot if you're the Miami Heat. Now, you're 14-7 at this point with the Heat. Do you want to go out and make a move when the Eastern Conference is already weak and you're already the third best team, you know, almost at the quarterway point in this season? But I think Miami Heat fans, Steve, would maybe even want Giannis as well and want to be their name thrown in there.
Of course. I mean, look what the Heat are doing now. They are playing at a clip offensively that, you know, nobody thought they had in them, but when you add Wiggins and Powell and Hero and the way Mitchell gets the ball up the court and how quick Bam is for a big, it makes sense. And they still play defense. It would be awesome. Now, if you're thinking about what you're giving back, though, I don't know if the Heat have the pieces. You know, I don't know if the Heat have the assets, you know, to trade back, because the Bucks would have to be doing this for their future. I mean, this is their franchise cornerstone. This is sacrilege. Like, if Bucks fans are listening and hearing this, You thought you got through it from the offseason. You thought, all right, once the season starts, buckle up. Giannis gives his all. Giannis gives his, 100%. But it just does look like the Bucks, maybe are just have seen their best days.
Number four.
Let's go back to the NFL, because the numbers are in for the Thanksgiving Day matchup between the Kansas City Chiefs and the Dallas Cowboys. It's officially the most watched regular season game in NFL history. The previous record was Thanksgiving, Cowboys-Giants in 2022 with 42 million viewers. Chiefs-Cowboys on Thursday, 57.2 million people tuned in, with a peak of 61 million.
Unbelievable.
Just beating the Thanksgiving Day parade at 34.3 million viewers. If you could only watch one, Mike, which one are you watching? The Thanksgiving Day parade or Cowboys Chiefs?
Cowboys Chiefs.
Colin?
You don't need to ask me. Steve?
It's close. I do think the parade was excellent this year.
So Snoopy.
No, you're going there. I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to bring that up. You know what my other thing about the Thanksgiving was? You know, they always obviously have the turkey now on the field after. Have you ever seen a group of players who were, everyone's hungry, more disgusted with the turkey than whatever the turkey was on Sunday Night Football? Like, you couldn't pay those guys to eat it. They were all like, maybe I'm not that hungry right now. Their faces were like aghast looking at the quality of the turkey. What was going on there?
It didn't look good. Steve, if you didn't want to get turkey, you can head over to Duffy's and get some real food, huh?
Number five.
Yeah, absolutely, Colin. Why wouldn't you do that? Because at Duffy's, their game is always on. It does not matter if you're talking about turkey or if you're talking about other great football goodies, such as the barbecue pulled pork nachos or the double smash burger or the touchdown tots even as well. And, of course, the award-winning wings, 2-for-1 drinks all day, every day, and the game day buckets all season long. No one does football like Duffy's. At Duffy's, our game is always on.
Appreciate it, Steve. As always, looking forward to talking again soon, all right?
See you guys.
Thanks, Steve.
Steve Palatino, the Good Karma Brands president, Palm Beach Sports Commission Hall of Famer, Palm Beach Gardens Youth Athletic Association vice president, giving us the time. Two straight Hall of Famers in the 5 p.m. hour. Presented by Good Greek Moving and Storage. Big thanks to Christian Kat, keeping us up over the airwaves. Stay tuned to our ESPN West Palm on socials to see all the signing day, national signing day, action from throughout Palm Beach County and the Treasure Coast. That's Mike Rizzo, Colin Russo saying so long. We'll see you tomorrow. Russo and Rizzo, ESPN 106.3.